listening to Eureka. I'm Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. This week, we do something a bit different, veering from the business world to tell the story of a nonprofit. When John Wood was on a trekking adventure through Nepal at the age of 35, he noticed the lack of quality children's books and learning materials. What followed next led him down a path to quit his executive job at Microsoft and create Room to Read, now one of the fastest growing nonprofits in the world. Today, John shares why he ditched his secure day job to deliver books to far-flung locations on the back of a yak.
My first job as an adult was actually as a CPA at Deloitte, which is about as exciting as it sounds. I went on from there after 2 years to go do my MBA at the Kellogg School at Northwestern. Spent 2 years doing banking. Didn't really enjoy banking that much. And in 1991, I was lucky enough to get a call from a friend who had ended up at Microsoft as a recruiter and told me about this great new company in the Pacific Northwest where you could wear shorts and flip-flops to work and call your boss by his first name. And didn't that sound a lot more fun than banking? So I ended up going to Microsoft in 1991 and spending about 8 years working there. It was a really exciting time. I think Microsoft was about 2 years post-IPO. They were growing like mad. I think when I joined, there were about 7,000 employees. When I left, there were 50,000. So it was hyper-growth years for the company. As a young guy at the company, it was also great because as the company grew, they would just throw more and more responsibility at you. It was, you know, if you'd been there for a year or 2 years, you were considered to be a bit of a veteran. So I was able to parlay that into some interesting assignments. I love to travel, and so I really wanted to do international marketing for Microsoft. So as I traveled through Taiwan, South Africa, Dubai, I started getting this idea that maybe I should move to an international posting. And I did run Asia-Pacific marketing for Microsoft for about a year, ran marketing for Microsoft Australia, and then eventually moved to Beijing and was director of business development for Microsoft's Greater China region, covering the mainland, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. In 1998, my friend Ben, with whom I worked at Microsoft Australia, invited me to go see a slideshow that a travel company was doing. They were showing pictures and slides and telling the story of this amazing 18-day trek in Nepal in what's called the Annapurna region. And over 18 days, you'd trek about 200 miles. You'd be in the company of 26,000-foot peaks, no phone, no communications, no connection with the outside world. And having been a bit burned out after 7 years at Microsoft, that sounded like a great thing to do. I joked that if you went high enough in Himalayas, you could probably escape the sound of Steve Ballmer and Bill Gates yelling at you to work harder. And so off I went to Nepal and did this 18-day trek that ended up really changing my life in a significant way. I was trekking by myself. Nepal is a land of absolutely spectacular natural beauty, but it's also a very hard place to live. It has one of the highest poverty rates on earth. They've never really had much of an education system. They've been isolated from the world for a long time. So while Nepal is a beautiful place to be a backpacker with, you know, all your high-tech gear, it's really a difficult place for the average person to live. And I think what struck me about Nepal was that coexisting with this natural beauty was this crushing poverty, but those living in poverty were some of the most generous people I'd ever met in my life. They just wanted to look after you as a traveler. I had been invited by a headmaster in a little village called Bahundanda to come tour his school. And I got excited thinking this would be a chance to see the real Nepal, not the tourist's version of Nepal. And like many schools in the developing world, it was both simultaneously hopeful and rather sad. Hopeful because over 400 kids were showing up every day. They wanted to learn, their parents wanted them to learn, but rather sad because the school was dilapidated, run down, dirt floors, and they had a completely empty library. They had a library room, but it was dark, dingy, and empty. And I asked the headmaster, why? How can you be missing something as basic as books? And he told me something that would forever change my life. He said to me, here in Nepal, we're too poor to afford education. But until we get educated, we're going to always remain poor. And that struck me as just the cruelest irony that you could tell any kid at age 5 or 6. Sorry, kid, you lost the lottery of life. You're born in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong family, and you will not get educated. That to me just seemed like I've got to do something to be able to help this headmaster. He seems very eager. The kids are here. And I think many entrepreneurial journeys start with the phrase, this can't be a hard problem to solve. That's what I said that day. I'm like, we got to help this guy get a library. What happened is I went back to that little village of Bahundanda a year later with my 73-year-old father in tow as my unpaid right-hand man. He got pretty excited about making this a retirement project. We had 6 donkeys that we'd rented with about 3,000 books. And it was like the biggest day in the history of this village. The whole village turned out. The parents, the teachers, the students. These kids had never seen brightly colored children's books before. And so when we actually took the books off the donkeys, the kids were like, it was like a mosh pit. The kids were like stage diving to get their hands on these books. They were so excited. And I think at that point, I started to mentally check out of Microsoft because I realized that one library, while it felt like a victory, was not enough. In a world of 770 million illiterate people, one library was really a drop in the ocean. So I started thinking that day about, well, could I do 2 more? Could I do 5 more? Could I do 10 more? Could I do 100 more? What might be possible? Well, I think for me, step number one was going out and finding the capital because I did not leave Microsoft with a gazillion dollars. I did not leave Microsoft with enough money to start a foundation and fund it all myself. I made enough money to basically start an NGO and take a risk and work for free for the first couple of years. So step one was finding the money. I did move to San Francisco and started knocking on doors, ranging from Bill Draper and Robin Richards at Draper Richards, Jeff Skoll, the founding president of eBay at his foundation, Mark Andreessen. Thankfully, a lot of tech entrepreneurs saw the zeal and saw the fire in my eyes when I said, like, I want to do for the developing world what Andrew Carnegie did for America. Carnegie gave America 2,500 libraries. Nobody's done for the developing world what Carnegie did for America. And guess what? You can open a library for like $15,000. And so what happened then is all these different tech and then bankers and then Goldman got behind it in a big way. Some of the banks got behind it. Credit Suisse was a big early supporter. And it just took off like I would not believe. So the funding coming in was good. Then secondly was hiring strong local teams, Nepalese in Nepal, Vietnamese in Vietnam. We didn't want to be a bunch of white guys driving around the developing world in Land Rovers telling the local people what to do. We wanted to have strong local control. And then third was finding the right early team. My co-founders, Dinesh, who was in Nepal, Aaron, Ganji, who's now our CEO. Aaron was like me. She's a corporate refugee. She's ex-Goldman, ex-Unilever. So we brought the founding team together. We started hiring really good people rapidly. And we took an approach that said we're going to be different from the average charity. We're not going to sit here and talk about the problem and whinge about it. We're going to act on a solution, have a mindset we call GSD, which stands for Get Stuff Done. Or if we weren't on radio, I'd probably have a different thing with the S of what the S would stand for. But we took a very results-driven, very data-driven approach to say, if we're going to do this, let's run it like a business. Let's treat it in the same way that a high, fast-moving startup in tech would treat it. Let's think big. Let's execute flawlessly. Let's wake up hungry every day. And let's accept nothing less than absolute rapid-fire growth to reach as many kids as possible as quickly as possible. Late in 2014, we were in Cambodia with a group of our investors. And what was really cool about this trip was that originally the big, hairy, audacious goal, or the BHAG for Room to Read, was to reach 10 million students by 2020. And that seemed like a crazy, capricious goal for a little cash-strapped, unknown NGO like ours. We realized by about 2012, 2013, we were actually on track to reach our 10 millionth student about 6 years early. And so we had a really big celebration in Cambodia, a country where we've been working since 2003. And it was really special because a lot of our investors were there, our board of directors was there, but also my co-founders, Dinesh and Aaron, were there. And I remember like going into the village where we're going to be like having this big celebration with all these kids and marking this 10 million student milestone. And I just remember looking at my two co-founders and saying, like, is this real? Like, can we just stop and verify that we actually have reached 10 million students? Because it just feels otherworldly. And the good news is now we actually have reached about 11.7 million students to date. We'll be at 12.5 million by the end of 2017. And we project by 2020, where the original goal is 10 million, we should now be at 15 million or above. So we're super excited about that, but we also don't want to be complacent or self-congratulatory because there's still tens of millions of kids who have never heard of Room to Read, tens of millions of kids who are not otherwise going to get an education. And I just think that every entrepreneur has to never really be satisfied until they get to the largest possible percent of their addressable market.
John Wood, founder of the global education charity Room to Read. Eureka's back again next Friday, but before then, tune into The Entrepreneurs on Wednesday. This episode was edited by Toby Hammond, and I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Thanks for listening.